greatest. Sweet. Sour. So good to taste.
Welcome to Great Taste at Green Building Supply. We're live as we are every first Tuesday. I am totally bookended by Kathy Dubois. Hi.
Hi, Stephen.
So isn't that cool? You don't have to.
Yes.
I don't have to go like that.
Right. And like get me closer.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah,
you can just talk away, right?
Yeah.
Yep. And this is my son, Jacob Boss. Hi.
Hi, Dad. Thanks so much for having me on. Great to be here.
Hey, I just want to say one thing. He brought some Indian food. He lives in Bloomington, Indiana. And he brought some Indian food that he had made. So we had it last night, and that was Monday. So he brought this food that he made on Sunday. Well, I made an exception and ate leftovers. And it was unbelievable.
It was.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic, wasn't it?
You don't need to give
No, I don't. Yeah, it's hard for
Such
me to remember.
Habit.
Right. It is a habit. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
And it had paneer in it, so what could be better?
Yeah. So we're going to talk about that.
My friends are always really amazed when I make paneer for them. They think that it's so fancy and so challenging. But of course, once you show them how simple it is, it's an amazing kind of little trick that you can do when you're entertaining is to make fresh cheese at home.
Yeah, you know, one thing I forgot to do was to remind everybody to turn their cell phones off, and especially the co-host, since she had hers on.
I did that on purpose so everybody would. Kind of.
It was a teachable moment.
Right, exactly.
Well, you have to wait till the microphone's in front of you, because otherwise it won't work.
I'll do my best.
Okay. So we are going to kind of have a lot of fun playing with summer stuff so that you guys can have great 4th of July picnic food. And we've done some of this stuff before, but it never grows old. And we're going to do a kind of a little bit of different take on it. And actually, the three of us have three different takes on it. But since Kathy made the main course, she gets to have her take first, and then Jacob and I are going to talk about our little ideas about how to change things up a bit, right?
Okay, let me go get what I made.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, go get what you made. And we have a lot of really different foods planned. We have condiment. This is a quick onion pickle that Kathy will tell you how to make.
And I love refrigerator pickles. Refrigerator pickles are another thing that is easy to make and impresses your friends. When they say, wow, you threw these pickles together so quickly, that's incredible. But really, they're quite simple.
And what's funny is, I was going to ask you this question, actually. The reason it impresses people is because they don't know how to cook. So what would you say is, you know, like the percentage of people in their 30s that are, you know, in your circle, what percentage of them do you think actually cook?
Almost none, because graduate students, even if they know how to cook, they don't have time to do it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, all right.
The interesting about pickled onions is it's not really, they're not cooked.
They are cooked, technically.
Because they're in vinegar?
Right. Just like, you know, when you make ceviche. Ceviche, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's cooked with the acid. Mm-hmm. Right, so that's cool. I mean, they're cooked in a certain way, but they're really cool. So we've got that, and what else? What are you going to show people?
Here we have
that up a little bit, maybe.
A nut burger, and it's something I've been making for a long time, and we may have even made it on the show number of years ago. Mm-hmm. But this was a recipe I found somewhere, and the recipe was for nuts, white rice, cheese, and chili powder. And I added a wild rice mixture, and
you actually changed. You dropped the white rice.
Yeah,
right?
I took the white rice out, and smoked paprika, and that's it. It's very simple, just those four ingredients. And I'm actually making some rice here because the rice has to be really hot, so that it melts the cheese and makes a burger. So I'll show you that one. That rice is almost done, and I'll show you how that goes. But that's the basic recipe. You both have.
Yeah, we have a little twist on it. But the thing is that, well, Kathy and I have had this discussion. Maybe I'll get your perspective on this then. We've talked about this before. We talked about it today. It's like you go to a restaurant that has, maybe they're a burger restaurant. And in today's marketplace, most burger restaurants have a vegetarian burger on the menu, whether it's something they actually make or something that they buy frozen and they serve or whatever. And it's usually pretty bad.
And most of the time it's beans, a bean burger. And I've just never been able to understand. This is so simple. It's like it doesn't take any amount of time to do. It's so much better than any of those other burgers. These are all like much more creative people than we are. Is it okay to include you?
You speak for yourself.
Anyway, I just don't get it. Why aren't burgers like this, you know, on menus places? Ah, you can't hold that. No. Oh, you don't know the rules, do you? Yeah, the rules are that no one touches this mic but
You'll
me.
Always be his son.
And the reason is it's not an
I've been a rebel since I was 10. What,
yeah. I've been rebelling against your rules since I was 10. So.
But here's the thing. You have to understand it's not ego. People think, "Oh, he won't give up the mic." It's because Jason Strong from Fairfield Media Center, who produces the show, says, "Don't let anybody take the mic because there's lots of noise that goes along with that."
That makes perfect sense.
Right.
That makes perfect sense.
So please.
What I wanted to say was that we should talk a little bit about why we don't like most restaurant veggie burgers so we can understand why this is such a superior alternative. So for example, if I have a product that is made to perfectly simulate a meat burger, well, I grew up vegetarian, so a perfectly simulated meat burger actually is a huge turnoff to my palate. I don't want to eat something that tastes perfectly, feels perfectly like meat. That's not something that I was raised, cultured to enjoy. Then if it's something like a vegetable burger that's rich in primarily vegetable matter, like broccoli and spinach and things like that, they're typically seasoned poorly and fall apart at a touch. You tap them, they crumble. You taste them, and they don't have enough salt, or they have a strong taste of iron or a kind of bitterness to them from the seasoning. And they really lack the kind of unctuousness and multi-layered appeal that something like Kathy's Burgers brings.
Yeah, it is really interesting. Now, on the other hand, even though he might have been raised as a vegetarian, I really like the taste of vegan or vegetarian burgers that try to mimic meat. And we've talked about this, I think, on the show. There's two big guys in the field, two big companies in the field, Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat, right, exactly. Thank you, Tom. So Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat. And they both have taken widely different approaches. Impossible Burger genetically modifies a yeast to mimic heme, which is evidently, I guess, I don't know all the, you know, major stuff, but it's like the thing in meat that gives it its flavor. And then they also, now in version 2, they also use genetically modified soybeans as the next as the biggest ingredient in it. And so you can go to Burger King and you'll be able to get the Impossible Whopper anywhere, but you really need to know what you're eating, you know, because that's, some people may not be interested in that kind of thing. So they've taken that one strategy. And the other company has the non-GMO certification, Beyond Meat, and they've taken a completely different, obviously, tact, where they're going down that road, and the major ingredient in their meat type burger is pea protein, and actually it tastes pretty darn good. And you can get that at Carl's Jr. and I don't know if there's, I'm sure other. No, I mean I'm talking about in a fast food restaurant setting. You can get that at Carl's Jr. and I don't know. There's probably some other places, but it's a pretty big battle. And what I like about it, it's so interesting, is that the lines are really drawn very dramatically. You know, you've got this one company that just is going all out with conventional food, essentially, and you got this other company that has said, no, we're going to take, you know, we're going to go this non-genetically modified way. So it's kind of interesting. And the only place I've had the Impossible Burger was at White Castle, and it was really awful. But people like it. So anyway, do you have any comments?
As a kid who grew up eating Hardee's sandwiches, Hold the Meat, which were just buns with cheese and ketchup between them when we would travel, I'm really amazed by the fact that you can get multiple kinds of vegetarian burgers at fast food restaurants. Unfortunately, I don't like any of them, but it's incredible how far the culture has come.
Yeah, and there are other chains around that specialize in different types of approaches, but these are the ones that are trying to mimic meat. And actually, if you listen to their marketing, especially the guy from Impossible Burger, he stated very clearly from the very beginning that he has no he doesn't care if one person who's a vegetarian or vegan buys his product. You know, he's only marketing to people who eat meat. And so it's that's another interesting approach, I think. Mary, you had a question. We won't be able to hear you, but I'll repeat it.
Ask people if they've heard about the real meat that they're growing in the...
About meat grown in laboratories? Yeah, that's going to be one of the next big things also. Right, yeah. So you've got kind of both. You got a lot of stuff happening. Let's put it that way. Yeah, a lot of stuff happening. Personally, we like to just cook our food from things that we know what they are. And we enjoy, you know, trying to get the freshest food possible. And luckily, we live in a place that's very easy to do for the most part, even in the winter. Which is great because we have an all-year-round farmers market, which is fantastic. And yes.
Hey, have you had the veggie burger that they have at the cafe and everybody's?
Have I don't think that I've ever. You asked if I've had that, and the answer is no, I haven't had that. So, but I'm sure a lot of people do make veggie burgers with beets. They like to do it that way so that it looks red, and also mimics meat. And it's okay, but you tell me after you eat this. What's the better burger? Okay, we'll see.
You might like the beet one.
Who might like the beet one? Mary. She might, but I bet she'll like that a lot. You know.
So I know a scholar who's produced a book-length volume on laboratory-grown meat. Is there a place where people can go to get extra resources that we mentioned on the show? A blog or anything like that? A website where we can post resources? Instagram page, a Facebook where I can share a link to the book, anything like that?
Yeah. Why not? You could just give it to me.
All right, I'll give it to you.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Okay, so we've got a lot to cover because we've got to do these burgers. She's got to show you how to make those. We're going to talk about oven roasted fries. We've got sweet potatoes and regular potatoes. We've got a really great dessert. Kathy's going to make an aioli. Which is going to be super on the burgers. And she's also going to talk about a little bit about how to make the pickles. So all that's going to be happening on the show. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention some of you were there. We had a fantastic event over the weekend where there was a screening of the movie Arendjarsi. We had two screenings. One of them was completely sold out, which was awesome. And a lot of support from businesses in town, including Green Building Supply, Everybody's, Whole Foods, J. Boyle, Gem, Aeron, Natel, help me out, Breadtopia, already said, yeah, Bob Ferguson, Shackley Distributor, Village Realty, Aeron, I said, yes, now they got mentioned twice. At-home store, fantastic. Selling all the tickets takes a lot of time to do all that. Frontline Printing contributed some of the PR material, so it was great. And it was everybody loved it. Everybody loved the screening. Poor Mateo has a screening in LA starting on Wednesday, and he's trying to get his car together right now
because.
Soil Tech, thank you so much, and Natel, yes, of course. And the great thing about it was. Not only was it a great event and there were lots of people, it was a lot of fun, but it raised money for the Lard's Cupboard Summer Food Program. And Laura Cohen, their executive director, is here with us. And I wanted her to come and talk about some aspect of, you know, contributions you can make to the Lard's Cupboard that I didn't have any idea about. And I was really excited to learn about that. So please.
Yeah. Yeah, so the thing that I believe you're talking about is fresh produce. We absolutely accept donations of fresh produce, and it basically goes out as quickly as it comes in. I mean, I've been there for 6 years. Over those 6 years, we've received anywhere between 4,000 and 9,000 pounds of produce a year, and it goes. There is so, so little that goes bad. It just doesn't sit there long enough to go bad. And, you know, it's, of course, every summer, depending on the weather, there's something that we get way too much of. You know, it's cucumbers or it's zucchini or it's tomatoes, depending on what's going on. But it all goes one way or another.
So let's say we have a garden, mm-hmm. and we have some extra whatever, eggplant, tomatoes, zucchini, what do we do?
Yep. Just bring it to the Lord's cupboard Monday through Friday, 1 to 4. It's great if it can get there early in the week, because that way it doesn't sit there over the weekend and get dried out or anything. But yeah, I mean, we even have people in the community who are planting an extra row for us. We've had quite a few kids who have planted little gardens because they wanted to be able to do something for the Lord's cupboard. So we'll take it all. And even there are some folks in town who really do some unusual vegetables and squashes and stuff. And we love it. You know, when folks bring things like that in, we say, okay, what is it and how do you cook it? And we pass that along to our clients, and they're more than willing to try new things. So they get really excited.
Yeah, that's really terrific. And I'm sure that these type of outreach efforts go on in most communities around the United States. And since this is on YouTube on the Fairfield Media Center channel, mm-hmm. you know, if you're listening or if you're watching this somewhere else, all you have to do is there an easy way to usually find out who handles those kind of efforts in a particular town?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually going to be as easy as calling your local food pantry or even the regional food bank, and they would know how to get your extra produce somewhere where it will be used well.
Fantastic. And in addition to that, the Summer Loaf Program obviously needs ongoing support probably for the summer. So do you want to just explain what that is?
Yeah, so the Loaf Program is a program that happens during the Fairfield School's summer break, and it is specifically geared toward helping feed the kiddos that are home from school. So more than half of the kids in the Fairfield School District qualify for free and reduced price lunches during the school year. But those are not nearly as available during the summer. So one of my fantastic volunteers came up with this idea 10 years ago to start up a summertime program to help those kids who are eating mom and dad out of house and home while they're home for the summer. And it's just a little extra food each week, kid-friendly food that hopefully has a little nutrition to it. And then we also do a small voucher that the parents can use to go buy, again, food. We're specific on the voucher about what they can buy. And it's, you know, typically fresh things and things that have some nutritional value. And it's just a $15 or $20 voucher that those parents can come in and get. But you'd think we were handing them $1,000. They are so excited about that little bit of extra help. So it's expensive. We do about 500 loaf orders each summer. So it adds up, but we really believe in it.
Thanks so much for everything that you do.
Thank you. All right.
Yeah, great. Laura Cullen, the executive director of the Lord's Cupboard. All right, we better get going, right?
I
don't need to do that, sorry.
Double me.
Yeah, go for it.
The rice is done, so I'm going to just show you how easy it is to make the burger. So we prepped everything, and here is a cup of pecans.
And we were talking, you can use walnuts if you want. You could toast them if you want, though. They get cooked in the oven. There's all kinds of different things that you could do. We think pecans and walnuts would probably be the two best choices
for this. Right? And then we've got a really nice cheddar, a sharp cheddar. But you can use whatever cheese you want, but the cheddar is really nice.
And that's Milton Creamery's, let's see, classic, I think, old-fashioned cheddar, I believe it is. And Milton Creamery, it's great because they're an hour away, so it's basically just local, and it is a really nice cheddar.
And then I'm really into smoked paprika. I don't know if everybody else is, but that, I think, adds a lot to that. So it's a teaspoon of that.
Yeah, it's good.
And a tablespoon of chili powder. I don't have a tablespoon, but, this is a half a teaspoon.
Oh, you better put more in there, huh?
No,
you better put more of that paprika in there, too, if you did that.
Yeah.
So the main thing here is that this recipe, other than the seasonings, is pretty easy. 1 cup of nuts, 1 cup of cheese, 1 cup, dry cup, of rice, wild rice mix. So it's 1, 1, 1. Yeah, it's all one.
Very simple. Tablespoon of chili powder.
And 1 tablespoon of chili powder.
And then you make sure your rice is hot, and you just put that in here and stir it quite a bit, and it'll coagulate into a burger. And then I freeze them just for a little bit, just so, because it holds them together better. So that's the basic burger.
That's, you can't get much easier than that. I mean, it's really, really simple. And you'll see how good they are. They're really good. But people do, yeah, that's it. I mean, that's how simple, really, it is. Now, the thing is that some people are never satisfied with recipes. They have to tinker with them. So we've always called this Kathy's Burger. These are Kathy's Burgers, right? But now there's another version, right?
I started making them for my friends in Bloomington, calling them veggie burgers, and they kept asking, where are the veggies, what veggies are in it? And as you've seen, it contains rice and nuts and cheese and no vegetables. So I decided that we needed a new name for them, and my husband over there came up with the name Wild Burgers because they're based on a wild rice mix. And I decided that I wanted to kick it up to the next level in my kitchen and try experimenting with different flavors. What I ended up doing was throwing in a whole bunch of different spices that add, I think, a kind of more layered and scrumptious experience when you chew through the burgers. I also bake my burgers off thicker than the burgers that were traditionally made in the kitchen with Kathy. And so I add, instead of smoked paprika, I use regular paprika, and I use applewood smoked salt to bring some of that smokiness in and the sweetness of the applewood smoked salt. And then I use garlic powder and onion powder and mustard powder, and I use some ajwain or carom seed. And ajwain, you have to be really careful with it because it can make dishes very kind of seem salty. So you just use a small amount of ajwain. And then I also use cayenne. And I am very particular about the cheese that I use because I think that the cheese has the most substantial effect on the flavor of the burger. So I'm pretty set on, I'm pretty convicted in the use of Kerrygold's Dubliner cheese. Or as my husband calls, Dubliner cheese. And so the Dubliner is a kind of sweet, firm cheese that has the properties of an aged cheddar, but it also has some of the qualities of a Parmesan cheese. You sometimes get the little white crystals in it. And it has a very rich flavor that lends itself well to, I don't want to call it a meatiness in the burgers, but instead a rich and textured mouthfeel and a full-flavored bite.
So sometime we're going to have to try that. We're going to have to try your particular version. But as I mentioned to you this afternoon, since Kathy was making these, I let her do it her way, right? Because don't want to
look. He didn't want to get in trouble.
Right, exactly. I'm not too smart, but I do have a few smarts too.
And a pinch of cinnamon.
Why?
Because my grandmother would always add a pinch of cinnamon to her savory dishes. So I carry the tradition on.
Right. And I like that. So what I would like to try, though, in terms of my own riff on that, is I'd like to do away with all those powders because I'm not a powder kind of guy.
And you're not cooking on a graduate student's budget.
Fair enough. And I would like to use, for example, fresh garlic in here. And also, I would like to put in, what's the other thing that I want that's fresh? I want
shallots,
right. I want to put fresh shallots in and try that. But I think, Kathy, you might be interested in her perspective because I thought it was a valid one. Why did you tell me that you kind of like it this way as opposed to all the other stuff that I might want to add or that Jacob might want to add?
Well, I feel like it's a base, and then you can do so much with it. I'm going to make aioli, and we have the pickled onions. You could use mustards and ketchups and pickles and coleslaw and, you know, a variety.
Sauerkraut.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I like to kind of keep things simple and then add, and people can make it their own. So.
And Kathy, you'll make your own ketchups, won't you, sometimes?
No.
No?
Never have.
And what kinds of toppings do you like to make other than the aioli?
I actually really like caramelized onions on them. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, very simple, easy thing to do.
Time-consuming.
And also, I use buns, so it's like a real burger.
She was really fighting for the buns to be here for this, and I said, no buns.
And, of course, if it's tomato season, a tomato or a little bit of arugula or, you know, everybody's got their take on what they like on a burger. But those things, I'll make the aioli, and you can taste that.
Yes, that sounds like a great thing. So before we move on to the next phase of the show, what I'd like to do is introduce, we have this thing that we've been doing for what, 3 or 4 months now, where I pick 4 or 5 products from everybody's Whole Foods and feature them so that people can see what we like to use in our kitchen. And so this kind of goes along with some of the stuff that we're doing. So we have Veginase, because we're going to use mayonnaise for the aioli. And I just like the grapeseed oil Veginase. That's what I've been using. I use it for years. I think it has the best taste. If you're not going to use a real mayonnaise, thank you. I appreciate that endorsement from one of our audience members. I got a thumbs up. I like that. So if you're not going to use real mayonnaise for whatever reason that you have, I think this is a great substitute, the Veginase.
I use it to make your New Year's artichoke.
Okay, so Jacob was saying that he uses it in an artichoke dip that I think we've made on the show before, but I can't remember. Okay, this is incredible. This is, what is it? No, it is traditional French vanilla pudding. It's brand new. It's organic. It's extraordinary. Somebody's going to walk away with it. As a door prize, of course.
How much is it?
It's in the dairy. It's brand new. It's like $3.99 or something like that. It is so, wait till you, but it's really, really good. Wait till you try that, baby. Wait till you try that, baby. If you don't make your own ghee,
for $3.99.
This is local. And we always use ghee quite often in cooking, in our cooking preparations. And so this is a local ghee called Spring Sunrise. I think it's just new packaging for John Revolinsky, pretty sure. Yeah, I think it's new packaging. But anyway, it's nice. I mean, I highly recommend that you make your own because it's also not difficult to do and it's really, really good that way. So, and there you go. So, I thought we did this last month, but I couldn't find the shelf talker at everybody. So this is the ketchup we're going to use on the on the burgers, if you like ketchup. It's got some nice flavors to it. This is Woodstock ketchup. And finally, this is rice vinegar, which Kathy did not use because they didn't have the one that we wanted, but I think they're getting it in. They have an organic rice vinegar, Myrokan organic rice vinegar. That's what we would say to check out if you can use a rice vinegar. Look for an organic one because the commercial process of making rice vinegar probably is many people who have discriminating who discriminate very clearly about what kind of ingredients they like, I think they might not like the process of making commercial rice vinegar. So get the organic version, it would be great. But we used, did you use just regular white vinegar or did you use
apple cider vinegar.
Apple cider vinegar. So that's another way to do it.
I like the taste of the rice vinegar much better. It's sweeter and it's more mellow.
Right.
But we didn't have that, so.
Right. So those are the featured products. And of course, everybody's Whole Foods contributes all the stuff that we make, and we really appreciate that because that's how you guys get to eat on this show every month, so it's really fantastic. Do you want to tell everybody what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm making an aioli, and it's one from Bon Appetit magazine a long time ago. It has cumin and coriander seeds that have been toasted and ground, mayonnaise, olive oil. We need olive oil. Smoked paprika again, and garlic. Pressed garlic. So it's very flavorful.
And it's really simple. You're just stirring the stuff in, right? You're pressing the garlic, right? Because it becomes that if you want that garlic flavor really pronounced, that's why you're pressing it, because the more cell walls you crush, the more intense the flavor is going to be. And opposite, if you don't want that garlic flavor very strong, don't crush a lot of cell walls. You know, cut the garlic clove in half, saute it in whatever oil you're using and take it out, for example.
Given what was said on Saturday night at the film about olive oil.
Olive oil, yes.
So
what Tom was bringing up is that in the film, Orange Arcy, that screened here, there was a discussion about olive oil where the maker, it was a Tuscan maker, said that about 80% of the oil that's made is lamp oil. That's what he said. Now, what he meant by that was that's all it was fit for, was to serve as light, to light to people's rooms so they could read a book or whatever. And I'm not so sure about that. I mean, this is one maker's take on it. But the truth is there's a lot of poor olive oil on the market. This has been going on for a long time. Everybody, you know, thinks that it's something new because what happens is it surfaces every 5 to 7 years. There's an article in the New York Times or something like that. And then somebody comes to me and, did you read that article about olive oil? I said, which one? The one from, you know, this year, or the one 7 years ago, or the one 7 years before that, or, you know, whatever. So it's just a standard practice that olive oil or other oils that are in demand may be adulterated so that it can go further. You know, think about it this way. Italy at one time, not anymore, but Italy at one time was the largest exporter of olive oil in the world. They were also the largest importer of olive oil in the world. What does that mean? That's pretty fascinating, right? So you do have to, knowledge is important, even with that type of product and with many other types of products. And so if you know the source, that's even better. It's not that easy to get really good olive oil. That's just the bottom line. And the best way to do it is to do some research online, see what other people who know about olive oil, you know, tell you. But frankly, to get a good olive oil is not an inexpensive thing. There are, Trader Joe's has many different olive oils. Matteo Troncone, who did the film, there's two olive oils that he likes at Trader Joe's and he recommended. One is a California, it's called California olive oil, I think it is. California State olive oil, he likes that. And he knows where it comes from, so he said that's a really good one. And then there's one that they get just for a few months, it's called Novello. And I'm sure it's really good, but the thing is that when you buy olive oil, it should always be in a dark bottle because there are two enemies to olive oil and most oils, and that's light and heat. So if you bottle your olive oil, this precious commodity, in a clear bottle, for me, that's just a message saying that whoever's doing that only cares more about the marketing of the product because it's got a great color or it's got a great, you know, look to it. They want everybody to see it. Well, if you care more about the marketing of the product than you do the product itself, I'm looking for a different product. That's just me. You know, that's just how I feel about it. The olive oil she used is something that we got off the shelf at everybody's. And frankly, you know, to be honest, I don't know the source of it or anything. You know, it's just olive oil requires a lot of research. And so I think that this is what was available to us, and so we're using it. Yeah. This is not the same California olive oil. I made a mistake actually at the screening and said that this was one of the ones that he recommended, but he didn't recommend this at all. This is probably
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, it's okay, but I don't know. I can't vouch for anything about it. So, and it is yes, it's in a dark glass, right? But I can't vouch for anything about that. I would only tell you about stuff that I absolutely know about, and so this is just it's just not one that I know about.
It did well.
Yeah, and okay. Well, so Jacob says this did well in the latest round of a reporting about adulterated oil. So that's great then. So fantastic. Okay. So what'd you say? How do you know whether it's true when you're researching? Well, you know, the best way that you know is if you actually know the producer, right? That's, and so for me, I try to find things that I actually know the producer, but I do that anyway. I go to the farmer's market. So do a lot of you. You go to the farmer's market. You're buying directly from the producer. You know them. You know, sometimes you know their family. You know their whole story. Maybe you've even helped out at what they do. So that's the best way to buy stuff because then you really know the source, and then you can move along from there. You know, to other areas that maybe you're not quite as close. In terms of a relationship. But for us, we had the good fortune to meet many producers in Italy over the years. And so we kind of know some things that maybe other people don't know or haven't had the opportunity to do. But you can also run into other things. You can find great stories on the internet and then you can check them out a little bit. Like there's a Spanish olive oil that I love to use that it's got a tremendous story to it because it's the story that has taken place all over the world, here and in other countries, where a farm that's been in the family for many, many years begins to lie fallow because the younger generation moves back to the city and the farm, you know, just kind of sits there. And so there is this farm in southern Spain where it's been in the family for over, I think, 400 or 500 years. But a few generations ago, there was nobody there to take care of it any longer. And now in the last couple of generations, younger people from the family have moved back. And the average age of the trees is 300 years old on this farm, which is really quite extraordinary in these groves. And it doesn't give the oil itself is very subtle. It's not the kind of a ripe oil that you might get from Tuscany, like the guy was talking about in the film, or from a harvest in Sicily. But it's just got a really nice mellowness to it. And the cool thing about the story is that the importer, there's only one importer in the States, and this importer is Spanish. His company, there's two people who own the company, and one of the guys is Spanish. And he knows this family, and so all the profits that come from the sale of that oil go back to the family to reclaim more of the land that's there. So it's a really nice, inspiring story. So those are the kind of things you can run into if you start doing research, if you've got the time to do that kind of thing. But so, yes. Yes, yes, she does. She does. Yeah, the at-home store has some nice olive oils also. Yeah, very nice. So it's always really nice. Bariani is a California oil that is a good oil. It's Emanuele Bariani. He does it all in there on his farm, and it's a good oil to get. So that's one of them. Really good. Yeah, it's in a dark bottle too. But you should also just be aware, you know, when you see the words, you know, pure olive oil, you don't want that. That's not what you want. You don't want pure olive oil is not very good. It just means that it's olive oil, but it didn't get there in a real natural way. So what you want to look for is you want to look for a number of things. You want to look for certain words that you might see, like first cold pressed is one thing that you can look for. Grown and produced in is another thing that you can look for. There may be certain labels that some countries have gotten going now that indicate that the olive oil was, you know, grown and produced in that particular country, so it's certified. And there are other things. But if you look really closely at a lot of oils, you'll see in very small letters, you know, where it comes from at the bottom. And that, even though it might have an Italian name or some other kind of thing, you may find that it doesn't really come from that particular area. Sure. Yes. Yeah. So there's a chain that's grown up over the last number of years where they have, I don't know, they call it different things in different places, but they have different olive oils from all over, and they have different vinegars that you can taste. And I'm certain that some of that stuff is probably, it might be good. I don't know enough to say one way or another. Normally, I would be a little suspicious, so I probably would still be a little suspicious. But it's probably, there's probably something you might be able to find there. I think that, you know, again, the most important thing is trying to know your source and really being assured, because it's a very lucrative business. So that encourages some people to not be to not do things right, not do things in an honest manner, right? So it's very important to, if you want to do it. And see, things are so advanced today that they can take low quality oil, mix it with other seed oils, and then add some really good oil and add some other chemicals to mimic the taste that they're trying to get at. Because think about it this way. If you buy a bottle of a particular olive oil and you've been buying it for 5 or 6 years and it always tastes the same, what? How could that possibly be? Because it didn't rain the same amount in that area every single, the temperature wasn't the same, the soil wasn't the same, nothing was the same, but the oil tastes the same every single time? Something's a little strange there. So you should definitely be able to tell a difference from year to year. The guy who made it, or the person, whoever it was, the robot, whatever, you know. Yeah, they might have been the only constant. Anyway, so does everybody know about the aioli? It's good, right? That's it? I forgot one product. Whoa. Ugh! Kato. Oh, yeah. Kato. This is deep, dark chocolate. It's really pretty good, actually. Made out of avocado. So avocado ice cream, and it's locally, it's not locally grown, but it's a local company. So that's another one we're going to give away. So everybody's Whole Foods has that, yeah, along with many other flavors, actually. So there you go. Okay, what else? What's next? Oven roasted potatoes. You want to tell people how to do that?
Are they're in the oven.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they're in the oven.
You want to tell them how to do that?
Give us the mixture quantities for the
aioli. Kath, can you do that? Mixture quantities for the aioli, please.
Well, we did four times the recipe, so I'll give you the recipe for one, if I can find it. Let's see. A half a teaspoon of cumin seeds. We can send this out, can't we?
Sure, we can send it out, but it's great to give it because then it's always there.
Okay. A half a teaspoon of coriander seeds, and you put them in a dry skillet and toast them and then blend them. Pulverize them. Half a cup of mayonnaise, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 teaspoons of fresh lemon juice, 1.5 teaspoons of smoked paprika.
No, slow down.
Can you do it slower?
We'll put it. We'll
like
if you're
a little bit slower.
Okay.
Okay. So where are you?
Makes for a great TV. But
we missed the olive oil and the
2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 teaspoons of lemon juice. Maybe you want to taste it before you write it down. And 1.5 teaspoons of smoked paprika and 1 garlic clove pressed.
All right. And if you're not on my mailing list, then this is a good reason to sign up and I'll send that out. So you can just let me know. And one thing I will tell people, which is really very important, is that if you give me your email address and you want to be on the mailing list, when you get a note saying you have to confirm, or otherwise you're not on the email list, even though you asked me to sign you up. Okay, that's important, because I notice people who still have never confirmed, you know, that are on there all the time. So we need to talk about the dessert. Who just yawned?
she has a reason.
Okay, that's fine.
Oh, yeah, should I bring the
bring out the dessert, and we have another important topic that we want to discuss, which is other than dessert. So tell us about the dessert, and then let's talk about restaurant behavior, because that's something that we want to talk about.
So the dessert is something that Stephen just, a recipe that Stephen just found. Where?
In the New York Times.
Okay. And it's heavy cream, sugar, and lemon zest, and a pinch of salt. And you just boil it and just keep stirring it and let it get a little bit thick. And then you take it off the heat and you put in lemon juice. And it thickens somewhat. It's not, it's, I guess it's custard consistency.
It's not pudding, it's custard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're trying it. We're all guinea pigs. We're
What's
trying
the
it.
Difference between the two?
Between what?
Pudding and custard.
It's a good question. I don't know. Is there, is it pudding?
Somebody
thicker?
Can look it up on their computer, on their phone, and tell us, you know, what it is. Huh? No, the question was, what's the difference between pudding and custard? And I'll let someone
custard
look it up and
eggs.
What? What? Oh, custard has eggs.
This
right.
is custard
this,
without
this
eggs.
This is custard without eggs, though. That's exactly what it said.
I see.
So it's not a real custard.
So it's custard without, it's faux custard, exactly. Very good. Faux custard.
But you know, it seems to me
well,
that
let me tell you,
pudding,
it's really
is,
good.
Pudding is thicker.
You have to come up here, though, Tom, so you can come up here. So this is great. So now we're going to get the real...
Custard versus pudding. Pudding is a sweetened milk or cream-based mixture thickened with a gelatinized starch, usually cornstarch or flour, that's cooked on the stove. Custards are milk or cream-based and are typically firmer than pudding. Moreover, custard usually has to be baked with a water bath.
Okay, well, this doesn't.
This is a no-bake, and it's not thicker than pudding.
Pudding? Can't hear you.
Yeah.
So we call this custard pudding cutting.
Oh, good idea.
I don't even get that.
Custard and pudding. It's a combination.
Cutting. Okay. Well, anyway, let's put it back in the fridge so it gets whatever.
And then we have
it's
strawberries.
Really, really good.
Actually, it's strawberries, and then they recommend a sprinkle of black pepper on top.
Oh, really?
So, Well, it's just strawberries.
That's beautiful.
I know, but they're gorgeous looking.
And they're macerating.
We should probably turn these on and get some burgers going, don't you think?
Okay.
Yeah, that would be really good.
We're not
good.
Eating.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Can we fight over dessert? Can that go in the freezer?
I did put it in the freezer for a little while because I didn't feel like it was cold enough, and I thought it would get a little thicker. But you mean keep it in the freezer and freeze it?
Until we bring it out, maybe it'll cool.
Oh.
But it's maybe okay.
We did do that.
We did put it in the freezer for a while. It's actually supposed to cool in the fridge for 3 hours, which it did. But it is really simple to make at home. It takes about a 20-minute prep period. That's all. So if you like it, you can find the recipe in the New York Times. Or if you can't get in because you don't subscribe, you can ask me for it. I'll tell you, it's like... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's two, I guess three ways you bake your burgers. I either saute them or broil them. So because we have something in the oven, I'm going to saute them.
And I like them sauteed. Kathy likes them crisp. She likes the crispiness on the outside.
Yeah, the cheese kind of gets crispy.
Yeah, you could grill them. You know, you just, the good thing about these, you'll see, is they generally stay together. And that's, you'd really need that on the grill, right? You know, to be able to stay together.
You might want to use a grill basket.
Maybe. Yeah. Or, but they're all cooked. I mean, there's nothing to cook. It's just a question of getting them warm through. Mm-hmm. And if you want some smoke flavor, that's another way to do it.
Is your email going to include the recipe for the burger?
Will the email include the recipe for the burger? Okay. Sure.
Sure.
It will. Yes. Of course, you'll have to remind me. And then we'll do it.
We'll be in
In English, probably. If Kathy was doing it, it could be in Italian, Spanish.
Or Yiddish.
Or Yiddish, right. Oh, yeah, she's fluent in all those languages. Afterwards, why not somebody can come up and have some conversations with her. I'm sure you'll find it very enlightening. So a subject that's near and dear to my heart is behavior in restaurants. And I've had this discussion with an executive chef recently who was complaining about how a lot of customers don't understand the relationship between the front of the house, the back of the house, and the customer. And I think that it's probably something that isn't well known, but it's really critical, and that is that if you're at a good restaurant, and when I say a good restaurant, I'm not saying that, you know, there's something wrong with TGI Fridays or anything like that, but I'm talking about somebody who's an individual owner, for example, who's putting their heart and soul into whatever they're doing. They're doing it for, almost all of them are doing it only for one reason. They have a need to serve. They have a need to serve people. They have a need to present something to people that's nourishing, and they want whoever's coming into their place to be nourished. That's why they do it, because it's a very hard job. And it's day in, day out, requires you to basically put your family secondary, that type of thing. So it's a very deep need that they have. Now, when someone has a need like that, then there's an obligation on the part of whoever is being served to understand why that is, you know, to understand how, where that person's coming from, and to understand then what's necessary. And what's necessary is that you just realize one thing. When you go to a restaurant that is a good restaurant, they want to have a relationship with you. They're really not interested in somebody just coming there, serving them, and having them walk out the door. They want to develop a relationship. That's exactly what they want, because that give and take, that energy that goes back and forth, becomes something that is exciting to them. It's just like going to a concert. I mean, all of us can relate to that. You go to a concert and the audience is really kind of quiet and withdrawn, not exciting. The band plays, that's how they play too. You know, right, blah, right? But you go to a concert where everyone's engaged, it's like crazy. I mean, it's supposed to last 2 hours. There's 12 encores because they don't want to even get off the stage. It's so much fun. So it's the same thing in a restaurant. Those people are there. The cooks are there. They're not getting paid a lot of money. They're not going home and buying, you know, a Lincoln Navigator or anything like that. They're there because they need to be there. They want to be there. They want to serve you. They want to make really great food and have you enjoy it. And so for you, it then becomes a need to participate.
it's a participatory relationship as opposed to a service relationship, which a lot of people think that it's a service relationship and they're mistaken. So if you understand that, then you're going to have even better experiences at restaurants because you're going to be in the flow of what they're looking for. So there's a lot of different things. I'm not saying, by the way, that, you know, if something doesn't go right, that you should ignore it because you want to have a nice relationship with who's there. I'm saying that there are ways to actually interact with the staff, whether it's the front of the house staff or the back of the house staff. And so try to, you know, essentially understand why these people are there. Even servers, a lot of servers are there because they love to serve. They love doing it. That's why they're there. Some of them, of course, are there because they need a job and they want to make money. But at really good restaurants, think about it this way. If you go to Europe and you're in Italy or France, a lot of the people that are serving you have been doing that for 20 or 30 or 40 years. It's a profession. It's not a part-time job. It's a profession, a respected profession. So this is why I think it's really important to understand, you know, your part, the part you play when you go to a restaurant. So I was in a restaurant once, and I heard one of the owners say to the other owner, table five walked. This is before they ate. Table five walked. It's because they didn't have what they wanted. And the other owner said, I'd much rather that they walked before they ate than after they ate. They were dissatisfied. And so that brings up another point, which is to tell people, you know, what it is. If something comes and it's cold and it's supposed to be hot, you're within your rights as somebody who's paying for a meal to ask the person who's waiting on you, hey, listen, could you please, but if there's a way to do it. And in a nice way, in an engaging way, you know, hey, my food's kind of cold. Do you think they could reheat it for me, you know, or whatever? And you'll find that that gets the kind of response 99% of the time that you're looking for. A lot of people I know never say a word. How did you like the restaurant? Oh, my food was cold. Oh, did you tell them? No. Oh, my steak was well done and I asked for it medium rare. Did you tell them? No. You know, and that's also, when you're talking about a relationship, that's something that the restaurant needs you to be participatory. They need to know. My steak wasn't cooked correctly, so that they can get it back to you. They want you to be happy. They absolutely want you to be happy. And so it's really important that you help them. You know, do they have to pay attention to everything that you say? No, because maybe everybody tastes things differently. Maybe you tell them that there's way too much salt in something and they're going to check it to make sure, but it could be that you're just really sensitive to a salt taste or something, and so it's different. But it could also be the other way, and this is how you know too, where you can decide next time I'm not going to go to that restaurant again. Like if you go and you've gotten soup there three times and every single time the soup's too salty, and you've said something to them like, wow, you know, maybe you should think about tasting, you know, have the chef taste the soup. I think it might be a little too salty. And you've never received any comments back, and it happened three times. I'm talking about a personal experience. Then you kind of just, you know, maybe that's not where I want to spend my money. Maybe that's not a place where I want to have a relationship, because they don't seem to be interested in a relationship because they're not communicating, you know, back with me. But in most really great places, there's going to be that communication. They want that give and take. The chef, somebody in that kitchen is actually looking at every plate that comes back. They're looking at it to see what's still on that plate. And then if it's a really great place, if they see a lot of stuff on a plate, they're going to say, who's serving that table? They're going to ask the server to go find out what the issue was. Why didn't you eat that? So it's something that came up, as I said, a few weeks ago with an executive chef who's a friend of mine, who was really upset about how he felt some people were very rude to their staff. So this brings up another point, which is an axiom for, you know, how we've always heard that customer's always right. Well, a friend of mine, Jeff Benjamin, who's a co-owner of Vetri in Philadelphia and Las Vegas, his axiom is a little bit different. The customer's always right until they're wrong. And one of the absolute cardinal rules is do not be rude or insult your server. Restaurants do not like that at all. So you might want to keep that in mind. Now, if you have an issue, ask for the manager, because the manager can solve the problem. The server may not have that ability, depending upon what the issue is. So ask for the manager in a very nice way. But and do that rather than writing a review on Yelp and saying, oh, this place is terrible, or, you know, that kind of stuff. That doesn't serve any purpose, really, in my opinion. It doesn't really serve any purpose. I mean, Brandon, you and I were talking to Gina from Asian Pho Bistro a couple of weeks ago, right? And Gina was talking about some of the letters that come, you know, people post about, you know, it's like, I took my food home. First of all, it took 40 minutes to get my food, and then when I got it home, it was cold. And she's like, well, okay, we tell you when you first come in here, that's our policy, to tell you how long it's going to be, you know, before your food comes. And the second thing is, I don't have any idea. Do you live 5 minutes from my restaurant or 55 minutes from my restaurant? Do you not have a stove at home that you can heat up your food if it's cold, or what? You know, so the restaurant owner is like helpless, basically, in a lot of this stuff. So I just think that the main rule is be kind and just understand that everybody's got and when you go somewhere, restaurants really, good restaurants are always trying to please you, because they really want you to have a great experience. They want you to come back. They want you to tell your friends, because they know also that for every person that walks out of there that's dissatisfied, they're going to tell a lot more people about that unsatisfactory experience than somebody who really liked it, how many people they're going to tell. So bottom line, be kind, and at the same time, tell people what you need when you have something that, if you want to, you know, actually get something across because it wasn't exactly the way you were looking forward to getting it. Yes?
Maybe they can start to rate the customers that are doing well.
That's kind of an interesting point. So Tom was saying maybe the restaurants could rate customers. That might be kind of fascinating, but it could cause a lot of issues too. So I don't think we'll get into that one. So this is, you can see that it's probably better to use either a non-stick surface of some type or a cast iron, which is basically non-stick if it's seasoned properly, to cook these, because there's a lot of cheese in them, and it'll just make your life easier, right?
Yeah, it'd be very hard to make these on a regular pan, a stainless steel pan.
Which also brings up a point in the grilling aspect. You're going to have to figure that one out, you know, so that it doesn't stick to the grill and just fall apart everywhere. Which, if you said, like, if you use a grill pan or something like that,
or you can spray it, I guess. Spray it with some kind of spray oil.
Yeah, maybe you could. Maybe you could do something like that. So those things are always important.
Kathy, when you bake them, how do you bake them,
and
do you bake that size?
I usually make them.
The question was, if you bake them, how do you do that? What's that?
I usually make them about twice the size, like a regular burger size, and I don't bake them. I broil them. Jacob's the baker. Yes, but Jacob's the baker, and I think because his burgers are thicker than mine, that baking is probably the way to go.
Yeah, I agree. When I make my burgers, I shape them into fairly small, thick moons, and those, what's the word, medallions. And when they cook, they spread out a bit. And so you get a nice burger shape, and you get a nice medium thickness. And then it has this, you know, really pleasant brown cheese crispness around the edges. The nuts are well browned, and it still has some give, some softness in the interior. It's not dried out.
Thank you. Next show, July 2nd, Green Building Supply, right? First Tuesday of the month. And it's going to be an Indian show. One of our guests is going to be Yasu Sharma again. She's going to have some new recipes for us. And I wonder if my lemongrass is going to be, I got to get my lemongrass put outside. I got to do that. Yeah, she had some great lemongrass soup when we last had her on the show. And there'll be other stuff. So it's going to be fun. I'm sorry that Jacob won't be here. But if you can be, you can cook, okay? Because as I told everybody, you know, you heard me, that Indian food was terrific. So any other points that you want to make before we, because we're almost at the end of the hour. It's been a pleasure to have you here again.
Thank
I'm
you.
So sorry that it's only once a year, but it's always great. Kathy and I were reminiscing earlier about how we used to drag we at the Crew Studios every week for years and years, right? We dragged all the equipment, the burners, the food, set up the table.
We had to clean it all before we could eat, before we could do anything, too.
And Jacob sometimes helped drag stuff. Anyway, it was quite fun. But
we were younger then.
And we can't even, I mean, neither one of us can imagine that we actually did that. Some of you were there when we did that stuff, right? Yeah, it was a lot of fun. One night we had 40 some odd people there. It was a Thanksgiving show. It was like crazy.
In the studio,
yeah.
I think I blocked that one out. Yeah.
And one night, I think I told this before, Kathy made, this is what you could do on radio. She made chocolate-covered strawberries, right? And it didn't turn out right. But nobody on the radio knew that because, oh my gosh, those are so delicious.
Yeah, they were chocolate-covered, but they weren't actually on the strawberry. Right. They wouldn't coagulate.
Thanks to Green Building Supply, making this place available to us and to everybody's Whole Foods for all the wonderful food. Jan Kolbling, you're nice to see you. I didn't know you were back in town. That's great. And, of course, the Fairfield Media Center, Jason Strong, for producing the show. And thank you all for coming. It was great. We'll see you on July 2nd.
Red Test. Sweet. Sour. So good to taste.